I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. There are state flags, state birds, state flowers, state mottos. There are even official state amphibians, I have learned. South Dakota has an official state bread and official state beverage as well. I'll let you wonder what those are in South Dakota. Pennsylvania has a proposed official state cookie, an official state crustacean for Oregon and Maryland. You see, officialdom is a very busy place, apparently. And where I live in Utah, we happen to have many of these symbols and a motto as well. The motto for the state of Utah is a single word, industry. And the state emblem, not the state insect, although it is an insect, the state emblem is the honeybee. And this originated with the white immigrants to the area, the Mormon pioneers, for whom the honeybee held a special place of honor. If you are as busy as a bee, then you are industrious. And so you see, our motto is in sync with our state emblem, and that helps me sleep at night. I want to talk about bees. Shall we do that? Not necessarily to delve deeply into the biological science today, although that's always very interesting. But I want to talk about the cultural interplay between humans and bees, what bees have been like as companions for us humans, the lore that has evolved over thousands of years, the way we folded them into our space, our life experience as near neighbors in human society. Seems a little bit odd, don't you think, that an insect should have been adopted by us humans as companionable in a way that stink bugs or horseflies are not? Okay, I am well aware that this compatibility thing has its limits for some people, such as those with severe allergic reactions to bee stings. But for the most part, keeping hives is a human thing, even if the bees themselves never really signed a prenuptial with us. Joining with us now to share her thoughts about keeping company with bees and the niche that bees have filled in human culture is Dr. Tammy Horn Potter. Speaking of officialdom, she is the official state apiarist for the Kentucky Department of Agriculture. She helps shape that state's pollinator protection plan and certified honey producers program. Tammy Horn Potter is author of several books, including Bees in America, How the Honeybee Shaped a Nation, and Beeconomy, What Women and Bees Teach Us About Local Trade and Global Markets. She's on the line with us. Tammy, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You know, I don't want to limit ourselves necessarily to talking only about the honeybee, because native bees are very interesting too. But I do want to begin talking about the honeybee as a newcomer, something of an interloper in the Western Hemisphere. How did that even get started?
So in the 17th century, English immigrants were, you know, bringing honeybees into the colonies, especially the Massachusetts, Virginia. Those areas were places that they wanted to plant apple trees. And of course, they needed pollination. So it's a great example of, you know, not only human migration being a reason, but as bees were brought to the colonies, the bees actually, the honeybees did better than many of the settlers did. The way that the Native Americans had taken care of forests, there was a lot of places where honeybees could swarm to initially. And so once the honeybees arrived in the colonies, they did very well. And they have been moving west in migration with both human, with settlers, and also on their own ever since.
So is this sort of environmentally problematic? I mean, I would imagine we're talking about an invader, right?
So I think when you consider the pollination services that honeybees bring to the United States, I don't see the honeybees as being an invader in the negative sense of that word. They do, in fact, provide pollination services for 90 different crops in our country. And if we think about the diversity of food that the United States citizens have, this is no small thing. I mean, if we think about watermelons and pumpkins and apples, these are all commodities that we take for granted. And of course, you know, they have to have pollination, and we are not able to depend upon native bees, as wonderful as they are, to provide the scale of pollination that we need in order to have the commodities that we have.
Yeah. So among the stories that I've bumped across, I understand that, among other things, George Washington had something to say about it, but in Pennsylvania, in Massachusetts, all over the place, people had customs and traditions associated with cohabitation with bees. You've kind of looked into that.
Yes, I wanted to examine what happens when a country adopts an analogy such as being as industrious as a honeybee colony and makes that social policy. And what I mean by that is that, as I mentioned, as these bees were brought into the colonies, initially settlers had very, difficult times getting established themselves. And so they adopted an analogy of using the beehive to help the morale of their colonists. You had to work. You had to work hard. Initial leaders, I'm thinking of James Smith in this case, did not want to acknowledge mental illness or depression or those kinds of things that may have impacted somebody's ability to work. And so the analogy of being as busy as a beehive came to be a matter of social policy. And it's something that we continue to this day, I think, in terms of dealing with some complex issues when it comes to poverty. And I think it's one of those things that we need to consider that maybe this analogy is no longer serving us as well as it could, that we have a better understanding of the beehive now. We have a better understanding of the role of male bees, which are called drones. They're absolutely necessary to the hives. But initially, the term drone came to be applied to anybody who was not employed. And it was assumed that the drone was a lazy entity of a beehive. And if a man was unemployed, it was very easy for him to get called a drone. And like I said, there's a lot of reasons why somebody may be unemployed. And so I think that use of that analogy is problematic.
This is so interesting you would say that, because I grew up hearing a few of the old folk songs and even some of the Sunday school songs that I remember one from my earliest childhood. It was antiquated then, but just before the chorus, it was "The world has no need of the drone." You know, it was you got to bad mouth those drones. They're lazy.
And, of course, now what researchers have taught us is that the drone has its own pheromone inside a healthy bee colony. And if that pheromone is not in a healthy bee colony, then the female worker bees will be demoralized. They will not work as industriously as a healthy hive that has drones. And so this is one of those analogies that we have borrowed back in the 17th century, before there was a lot of science to support these ideas, that we need to rethink and maybe get rid of. Yes.
So I kind of hear you saying that in the early days of the colonies and the early days of the United States, that the beehive, bee society, was held up kind of as a role model to bespeak what a moral society would be like.
That's correct. And it was especially effective. The symbol of a skep, which is a woven rye grass that was turned into a hive. The skep is a Scandinavian word for pot, upside down pot. And of course, it became a very popular image. especially in colonies that had this influx of not only, you know, German immigrants, English immigrants, French, Spanish, you had Native American colonies, tribes throughout the colonies. The image of the skep was a very powerful symbol to unite what was a very complex and divided system of colonies. And it wasn't just divided in terms of these immigrants. You had all of these different languages. You had all of these different currencies. And in fact, one of the surest types of currency that could be counted on, regardless of your nationality, regardless of the type of money you held, or your religion, was beeswax. You know, that sort of undercut anything that, you know, you could count on that having some value, regardless of what, you know, was going on once the American Revolution started and, you know, the issues of inflation were being compounded because the British were counterfeiting all of the Continental Congress notes. You could count on beeswax being stable. And you could count on honey always having value. And so those two products from the hive were especially valuable throughout the colonies. In the you know, by now, of course, we're talking 18th century, but in the 17th and 18th century, the colonies really appropriated a beehive for a lot of different uses. And certainly currency exchange was one of those it was absolutely a priority on the frontier to be able to produce honey and beeswax.
So kind of bartering maybe with honey.
Sure.
And beeswax? Yeah.
And the medicinal qualities that come along with the honey when people don't have ready access to medical facilities.
Although this is all new to me, the idea that somehow they were using those products as medicine?
Oh, absolutely. And in many places, you know, here in Eastern Kentucky, I was born in Harlan County, honey is still used quite frequently as for cough syrup, especially for children. You know, this is a good steady standby.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the present day, I want to tell you a little story just because this kind of demonstrates how estranged we've become from beehives and honeybees in modern society. I grew some flowers years ago, a beautiful flower called the New England Aster, and a neighbor friend of mine thought they were beautiful. And I said, oh, I'm happy to divide those and give you some. So I gave some of these plants to my neighbor, and they ended up in my neighbor's yard and grew for a season. And then this neighbor apparently was scandalized by the fact that they attracted bees. And within a year or so, those flowers were pulled out and discarded. Now, I get it, because there may have been a bee allergy there, right? And that's important, anaphylactic shock and all of that kind of stuff. I get that. But in suburbia, we don't live side by side by bees anymore. That's just such an agrarian thing. That's a thing of the past. And I'm wondering if you could comment on how ubiquitous beehives were among early Americans. Were they sort of just a household thing?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And it was a type of agriculture that women could be you know, women beekeepers have been part of this type of agriculture, you know, since the colonial days. In fact, there was even a phrase called a deputy husband that a wife would have as part of her title, especially if she were married to a mariner, for instance, who could be gone at sea for months at a time. And, you know, she would need to be able to conduct business. And so, you know, deputy husbands routinely had hives. They would have them as part of their backyard agrarian ventures, hand in hand with chickens, typically. You know, and so it wasn't a type of agriculture that was just associated with men. Women were also noted beekeepers, and they contributed to their family's income, you know, not, like I said, in addition to the eggs that their chickens would provide, also the honey and the beeswax.
There were no guild secrets here, were there? I mean, was it, would most anybody have known how to tend bees, or was this very specialized work?
I don't know that it was super specialized, but it did require some skill. Of course, there weren't the pressures that, you know, modern beekeepers face in the terms of varroa mites and, as you mentioned, the lack of pollinator habitat that suburbs have created, you know, viruses. You know, we know so much more now about the pressures that hives are facing. But, you know, at that point in time, there were a couple of diseases that were certainly known in the earlier years, and by earlier years, I mean 18th century, early 19th century. But many beekeepers found themselves keeping hives in ways that they could not necessarily manage. And what I mean by that is that early beekeepers, 17th, 18th, even 19th century beekeepers, kept hives in trees, what we call bee gums. And we call them gums because the black gum tree has a tendency to, when it decays, it will decay from the inside out. And that vacuum created in the middle of the tree is a perfect place for a swarm trying to find a sheltered place to be. And so you have a lot of beekeepers who keep their hives in these bee gums, and that makes it very difficult for the beekeeper to check on their health, because, you know, they, you know, now we have a, what we call a movable frame hive, and a beekeeper can go inside a hive and pull out a frame, and we can check and make sure that that hive isn't suffering from a disease. We can check to see if the queen is in fact laying eggs. We can also check to see if the frame is has honey on it and if we can harvest our honey. So the movable frame hive, which comes into existence in 1853, changes the nature of beekeeping in ways that help make it a manageable agriculture. And again, women are a part of that transition. You know, so even though it may be heavier, you know, the equipment is heavier, it changes. Women are still keeping up with their male colleagues when it comes to keeping bees. And there's a great example of that in the Shaker community villages, which that Shakers were committed to equality between the sexes. And so there were very skilled women beekeepers that worked along with their male colleagues.
Now, you know, from everything you just told me, I just suddenly realized that Winnie the Pooh's honey tree was probably a gum tree.
Correct.
Well, okay. We're going to talk a little bit more about the interaction between humans and beehives after a short break here on our show. We're talking with Dr. Tammy Horn Potter, and she is the state apiarist for the Kentucky Department of Agriculture. She's author of Bees in America, How the Honeybee Shaped a Nation. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. It's a great pleasure to have with us Dr. Tammy Horn Potter. She is Kentucky State's apiarist for the Department of Agriculture there. She knows about honeybees and bees generally, and specifically, too, I understand, she's author of Bees in America, How the Honeybee Shaped a Nation, also a book titled Beeconomy, What Women and Bees Teach Us About Local Trade and Global Markets. Tammy, I wonder if we can go back to, I very briefly mentioned George Washington. There's quite a folklore that came about at some point, some old fable or story about a little girl who saved our country. What happened there?
So, according to the story, there's a Quaker girl named Charity Crabtree, and she happens upon a wounded soldier who has a very important message for, you know, General George Washington, and that is that the Redcoats are coming. And so, the wounded soldier hands her the message, and she has to figure out how to get this message to General Washington. And she knows that she doesn't have enough time. So what she decides to do is to upset all of her beehives. Of course, they are kept in skeps at this point, which are situated along the road. And the bees, of course, attack the redcoats. And that gives her enough time so that she can make it to General Washington. And he is quoted to have said, "It was the cackling geese that saved Rome, but it is the bees that saved America." And this story, of course, is a riff on many other stories that came to us from Europe about nuns saving the convent that were being attacked by the Vikings, and the nuns would throw their skeps over the convent walls, and then, of course, that would cause the Vikings to run for cover.
You know, none of this is credible, is it?
Well, you know, that there is a lot of stories like that when it comes to beekeeping. That's we have a nostalgia when it comes to our bees and what they can do to protect us.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk more about this, the comfortable friendship between humans and bees, because at some points in history, certain customs, certain practices came about, such as, you know, informing the bees of what was going on in human lives. You know, to tell the bees, what would people tell the bees?
Everything. You know, there's a custom that started well before the colonies were established, and this custom was in Eastern Europe, probably goes back earlier even. But this idea that once the beekeeper has died, that the family should gather around the apiary and sing and tell the bees, make a formal declaration to the bees that the beekeeper has died. And that, of course, progressed to telling the bees when people would get married. All of the family news would be shared. And in fact, these customs were being played out in Kentucky into the 1960s. I go to church with somebody who can remember when his grandfather died, that the whole family marched out to the apiary and sang his favorite hymn and then announced to the bees that he had died. And, you know, there's a therapeutic quality to that type of ceremony that contrasts quite sharply to our modern customs of funerals. You think about how expensive a funeral is today. You know, when you consider how much a coffin is, right? I mean, you have to think about, okay, am I going to get this coffin, or am I going to spend a little bit more money because I don't want to put my loved one in a super cheap coffin? You know, all of the parishioners will talk. And then you have to maybe think about flowers. You have to think about.
You even have to keep up with the Joneses when you're dead, don't you?
Absolutely. It is not an inexpensive occasion now. This is, you know, the pine box is not cool. And so I think for many reasons, 20th and 21st century audiences latch on to this tradition because it's very simple and it's therapeutic, you know, in terms of actually talking it through, you know, announcing this major life transition of this loved one to these bees. I think it goes back to St. Ambrose, who was often associated not only with bees, but the fact that his words bees and words would go hand in hand. And it was thought that the bees would take your words directly to God. And the bees were the intercessories between you and God. And so this, I think, has, you know, played itself out in different ways. But certainly in the United States, this tradition held on. It took root because we were so removed. Colonists were so removed from their home institutions that they kind of had to create their own on the frontier.
Now, you are fond of bees. This is no secret. You've spent a lifetime with bees. And you clearly see beauty in these traditions, these old practices of telling the bees about what's going on and with the passing of humans. I'm just wondering if you've ever talked to bees.
Oh, absolutely. All the time. The whole notion of when I have a loved one that has deceased, you know, I have three hives out on my back porch, and that's not a tradition that I take lightly, but it is a calming process, and it is the one thing that I can do when I feel so helpless in the face of more enormous challenges in front of me. I'm speaking specifically of COVID. This pandemic has forced our entire nation to consider its routine rituals, such as visiting people in nursing homes, you know? And so the one thing I can do is tell the bees about my loved ones who I may not be able to see, and I may not be able to say goodbye to.
Now, have you known about this practice of moving the position of a beehive upon the passing mm-hmm. of a loved one? What's that?
So the thought here, to me, I think it's as much of this whole idea of telling the bees when a beekeeper has died, to me, is as much about making sure that the family then designates somebody else to take care of the bees. And so, because there's a real fear that the bees will be neglected once the beekeeper has died. And so when, you know, you have this, Robert Morgan has a beautiful poem about telling the bees when the old one has deceased. And so that the tradition in Eastern Kentucky is to go and move the bees a quarter of an inch, you know, just enough, you know, to acknowledge that there's been this change, you know, but at the same time to have this understanding that there is somebody there who's comfortable enough to move that hive and to take responsibility, and that there's a passing here of the generations, you know, that there's a passing of the torch here to the next generation.
A moment ago, you were talking about the calming effect of passing word to the bees. You tell a story about it from your very own life. It has to do with your grandfather, and you say that he was a calm and docile fellow around his bees.
It was a surprise to me because I had not seen that side of my grandfather. And the day that I volunteered to help him, in my mind, it was only going to be for one day. And once we opened the beehive, and, you know, it was in my head, you know, I had no experience with a beehive whatsoever prior to this day. And so I had assumed that there would be these hordes of bees that would be, you know, flying up out of the hive and being very aggressive. And it was not that at all. I mean, it was in the morning, it was cool. You know, you had a couple of bees that were kind of wafting on the air and sort of looking at us curiously because it was morning and we had a smoker going. And my grandfather was talking in this tone of complete peace. And I had not seen that side of him. And it was a total transformation that then, you know, I spent the rest of the summer with him. And of course, it changed the course of my life because I realized the enormity that he was facing. He had a disease that had progressed through the winter, and he had 60 hives and needed somebody to help him manage that, manage everything, you know, lighting a smoker, pulling out the frames, all of those kinds of things. And so for me, in that one summer was transformative.
Were you a quick study?
Yes. I devoured any book on bees I could get my hands on that summer. I had never known something like apiculture to exist. You have to understand, I grew up on a pig farm. I was determined.
Nobody goes out to tell the pigs.
No. And the pigs actually can be very cranky when you are not there on time to feed them. And so, you know, so when I went to college, I was determined never to do agriculture, math, or science. Those three things, you know, were not on my priority list. And so I graduated from college with an English degree and had absolutely no interest in taking care of the farms, taking care of anything with agriculture. And of course, the great irony now is that I do all three every day, and I love it.
For the Department of Agriculture. Yeah. Well, okay, the passing of hives from generation to generation, is it still the case that this is done within families?
Oh, absolutely, especially among the commercial beekeepers. That's an especially intergenerational industry. And it's the only way, you know, that many of the younger generations have a prayer of getting started. Because if a bank hears that you're a beekeeper and that you need a loan for, say, a flatbed truck, first of all, the bank doesn't know anything about beekeeping. Secondly, when they do know something about beekeeping, they definitely don't want to give you a loan for a flatbed truck. You know, the challenges are that high against a young person being able to make it in the beekeeping world. So for many young people, it helps to be able to work with your family who have land, who have resources, who have good relationships with bankers, that kind of thing. And many are finding that their daughters are the next generation of beekeeping leaders.
Has there been a problem with attrition in the ranks because of bee colony collapse? Is that what has been hitting the industry? And are there fewer and fewer beekeepers?
So when we talk about the types of beekeepers, we typically categorize them in three classes. And so the one class that has the most beekeepers would be your hobbyist backyard beekeepers. And that's, you know, there are a lot of those. And especially in the wake of, you know, this perception of colony collapse disorder. I think scientists now use the term colony decline or hive decline. They no longer use that acronym as much as they used to anyway. But the media attention on that, you know, has just kind of buoyed a whole nother aspect of the backyard beekeeping experience. Then you have your sideliners. And the backyard beekeepers tend to manage between 1 and 30 hives. The sideliners will tend to manage between 30 and anywhere between 200 and 700. And then the commercial beekeepers are the smallest of the three classes. And of course, the commercial beekeepers are running thousands of hives, but we're talking maybe 2,000 families for the entire United States. And the pressures on them are substantial. You know, they have to find areas where there is enough floral resources for their hives. And what I mean by that, every single hive, I don't care what class you're in, you know, every single hive typically on average needs 252 million flowers. So think about your New England aster that you planted in your yard. And not only do you need some of those, but you need other types of flowers that are going to bloom once that New England aster is no longer blooming. You know, so you need early spring bloomers and late spring bloomings and, you know, early summer, late summer, and the New England aster in Kentucky tends to bloom in the fall. And then you need your late fall bloomers. So when you have thousands of colonies, that's an issue. And especially where you're located, you know, you can have 1,000 acres of star thistle. And if you have a drought, there will be what's called a dry bloom. There's not a single drop of nectar in all of that star thistle. So now as a commercial beekeeper, you're having to feed, you're having to provide some type of supplement because your flowers aren't able to produce nectar. So there are a lot of issues like that.
Now, you, in your function with this pollinator protection plan, you've almost had to become a botanist, too. You have to know your flowers.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the thing with being a beekeeper, and I don't care if you're an apiarist or commercial or honey producer or just a backyard person, it opens up the world of sciences in ways that you end up walking into without even realizing it. So you walk into chemistry because the hive is a collection of chemicals. We talked about the drones and how important their pheromone is to a healthy functioning colony. But the queen has pheromones too. And the juveniles have pheromones, you know, so it's a collection of chemicals. And part of your role as a beekeeper is respecting that and understanding what chemicals you as the beekeeper are bringing, right? So, you know, that's one aspect of the sciences. Botany, you mentioned, and the world of botany is fascinating. Once you start learning how flowers have evolved hand in hand with honeybees, you never take them for granted again. You know, you start noticing things like the floral guides in the petal structure and the nectaries that produce these amazing perfumed scents that attract pollinators, but also attract humans. It's a lifelong science class. And then you have to know the parasites and the diseases. And so all of a sudden you become a virologist, just like suddenly last year in 2020, we all become virologists because we're understanding some more about COVID. It's the same with bees. I mean, sometimes they get sick. And so you have to be able to recognize those symptoms, understand the differences between bacterial diseases and viruses and which ones antibiotics will work with and which ones won't.
Well, you know, Tammy, among the various people who might hear you talking today, some of them might already be backyard beekeepers. Few of them are likely to be in it commercially, just in terms of the statistical probability of that. But there are going to be a lot of people who will never have hives in their backyard that they are managing, but they have gardens. And so this aspect of having some degree of expertise about the flowers and how they support bees, I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about this. This is so interesting, the idea that seasonally you have to have the progression throughout the year with a sequence of things in bloom and certain types of plants. What kind of advice do you give people that anybody could follow in terms of what they plant?
Container gardening.
Well, why that?
It's, first of all, not expensive. Secondly, you can go a long way with container gardening, herbs especially. And the ones that come immediately to mind are mint and thyme and rosemary and sage. If you start these plants in containers, first of all, not only will you help the bees, but you yourself will benefit from them. And I think that that's key. I think for many people, if they can just get started with herbs, first of all, herbs are forgiving. They can handle drought. They can handle a bit of neglect. You know, they don't have to have water every single day. But if you let them flower, you'll begin to kind of get this appreciation between the bees that will work their flowers, but you're also benefiting your own diet. You know, you're also being able to bring something to your own table that I think is especially nice. Basil, for instance, if you let that flower, the bees will pull the oils off of those basil flowers, but you yourself can also, you know, add another element to the dishes that you are cooking for your own family. And I think that that's a big step in moving towards incorporating wildflowers into your suburban garden. And container gardening, of course, can be quite limited. You don't get mint invading your entire backyard.
Right.
You have a little bit more control there.
Well, is there something important about the placement of these? Are the bees just going to come if you plant it to wherever you plant it?
Typically, yes. You know, when you're, especially I think with suburban yards can be difficult because many people in Kentucky, I need to specify, have contracts with weed companies that will apply a spray to keep mosquitoes down where I'm located because water is an issue. But as I said, I mean, most of the time your herbs, they need full sun, and container gardening lets you place them where they will do best. And you know, so you don't have to dig up your yard, or you don't have to, it helps you work with your neighbors too. I think sometimes people get a little bit concerned if, you know, and for instance, I'm a case in point. I have understanding neighbors, but I do try to, when I have my wildflowers and I'm getting ready to put wildflowers in place, I'm also cognizant that there are people that don't want a prairie right beside them. And so that I need to choose wildflowers that, you know, are going to do well in certain areas of the yard that are not right out front. You know, those are in the back. I'll let the really invasive ragworts take over. It's called butterweed too, take over my backyard. But the front, you know, those are where my herbs are, my culinary herbs.
Okay, I want you to level with me now. Just be absolutely honest. Don't you wish that our human culture would change so that those values of whatever our landscaping has been, that people can start having a new aesthetic that is actually a little bit more friendly to the pollinators?
To me, the grass industry is the biggest ripoff of the American public. I would love to have, you know, just a whole scale reconsideration of how it is that we manage suburban landscapes and public areas such as universities. We spend an enormous amount of money and time maintaining fields of grass that have very little value to either pollinators or humans that I can tell. And of course, that transition happened in the late 19th century. And so it's, you know, we're holding on to it with our cold, dead hands.
You know, there's got to be a way to invite people in a friendly manner, but to invite bees back into our lives. And if you make the case, don't you think if you make the case that a nice green mowed golf course kind of lawn is a sterile environment where very few things can live, if you tell that story, do you think you could ever persuade people?
So I think you tend to get further down the road if you talk about butterflies.
Oh, really?
And of course, bees benefit from the same plants that butterflies benefit. But, you know, I have found that that's an easier sell, that people will plant things for monarch butterflies and not think twice, you know, whereas if you say, well, these same flowers are great for honeybees, there's a little bit of apprehension.
Yeah, you're doing the kind of a bait and switch, aren't you?
Exactly. Absolutely.
And it's worth it, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, you know, if you and I were to get together and talk about what to do for the future of our children and for the health of food systems and for the environment, we would have to tell the story of not just butterflies, but the story of bees. And I'm wondering if, as you watch American society, do you see us turning a corner? Do you think that we are, in fact, slowly welcoming these pollinators, the bees too, back into our human society, into our suburbs, into the places where we actually live?
Yes. In my role as state apiarist, I am seeing this happen. Especially during swarm season, which in Kentucky starts in April and it runs well into the end of May. You know, I'm getting calls even right now as we speak, where people do not want to harm the bees. And so they're reaching out because they want to find a swarm removal specialist because they know that they're important. And, you know, and typically we end up having a conversation about where can they find local honey? You know, what can they do to support local beekeepers? And so I do think that we are in a transition that is still happening. We've got a long way to go, but I'm optimistic about the future.
It's a very heartening story you tell, and I'm just so glad to have a chance to put you on the air to have you tell it. Tammy, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and thank you for the invitation.
Dr. Tammy Horn Potter with us, the Kentucky State Apiarist for the Kentucky Department of Agriculture. She is author of Bees in America, How the Honeybee Shaped a Nation, other books about bees, and she's also the runner, the person who is in charge of their pollinator protection plan and Kentucky's Certified Honey Producers Program. Some people eventually do learn that their personal comfort zone has room for bees. I'm almost there myself. But there was a day in my life when I wanted to put a whole lot more daylight between myself and a hive of honeybees. I'll tell you what happened after this on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to Constant Wonder. So here's the story. I had an older brother who decided he was going to be a beekeeper, and eventually, after he was done with the bees, he turned them over to my dad, and my dad became a beekeeper. And with a hobby like this, you have to have all the right gear. You know, the suit thing and the hood and the mask. You got to have the little smoker, the little bellows. We were talking about that earlier this hour, the bellows where you smoke the beehives to make them docile. I don't know why smoking something would make you docile. But that's what we had in our family, all the gear, the boxes, the frames. We knew about bees. We learned about them. We read about them. Bees were part of our family. There came a day when my dad needed to move a hive, and he had just the vehicle to do it in. It was a very old postal truck made by Jeep. It was essentially just a can, a big metal box. You know, it had that rolling back door that goes up, and then the driver's side on the right-hand side of the vehicle. That's the way with postal trucks. On the right-hand side, a front door as well. Dad had said to me, why don't you come along and help me with this job? And I said, okay. And that was the folly of my lifetime, perhaps. Because up one of those steep San Diego hillsides, our Jeep gave up the ghost. And when it did, not only did the engine fail, but the brakes too, and there was no way to prevent us from rolling backwards downhill. Well, what was to stop us? What did we crash into? We were very fortunate in one sense that we hit no other vehicles. We rolled off the road and were stopped abruptly by a cable that supported a telephone pole, a power pole. And everything ceased to move except for the hive, which toppled over. I got out the front door before my dad did, and he was driving. Now, I don't know what other people may have seen that day. Well, there's a postal truck. It's going up a hill. No, it's stopping. Oh, it's rolling backwards. It looks like it's out of control. I wonder if they have bees in there. Do you think they might have some bees in there? Honeybees, I hope. I do like honey. I don't know what people were thinking, but it was a very precarious situation. I didn't come away with any stings. Dad did. And the miracle of all of this is that even after 100-plus bee stings from that experience, and a lost hive, by the way, they swarmed away, who knows where they went, he didn't give up beekeeping. He kept at it for years and years. I grew up with Dad extracting honey in a big barrel of an extractor device. If you haven't seen one of those extractors, they're really remarkable, the old-fashioned kind where you turn the handle with the crankshaft, and that rotates with its gears the frames of honeycomb, and gradually the honey flows to the bottom, and you turn the tap, and out it comes. Well, this is all just to say that it's possible for most of us to live pretty close to bees and get stung a few times and still keep them in the family. Maybe there's a life lesson in there somewhere. I don't know. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Tomorrow we have a great story for you. There are two paintings that face each other in a gallery at the Louvre. Mona Lisa directly across from an immense canvas that's 165 times larger in surface area than Mona Lisa. It's a masterpiece of epic proportion. But there's a bitter irony here because few visitors ever recall having seen it, which adds insult to injury because the painting was plundered from Italy by Napoleon to begin with. We've got for you tomorrow a very big story about a very big painting and the very big ego that wanted it. That's tomorrow. Join us for more Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.